From 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. On today's show, the Journal Sentinel reporter who broke the story of suspicious alcohol poisonings at upscale Mexican resorts.
Later, a conversation with the CEO of Wisconsin-based insurer Network Health.
Former speed skater Bridie Farrell reflects on how things have changed since she shared her story of sexual abuse 4 years ago.
The environment of one woman doing it, 2, 4, 8, that tidal wave is what's allowing it to happen. And from a personal standpoint, every day is really tough. But from a personal standpoint also, every day is amazing.
And American Ninja Warrior Abel Gonzalez discusses how he's overcome a major challenge to becoming an athlete, rheumatoid arthritis.
I just knew that if they couldn't help me, then I was going to do it myself. I wasn't going to accept that because this was my life. I wasn't going to let an illness take it away from me.
Keep listening. Lake Effect is right after this news.
This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. Thanks for joining us. I'm Joy Powers.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Since July, the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel has been reporting on a series of stories about tourists at Mexican resorts who've experienced mysterious blackouts resulting in robbery, assault, rape, and death. The culprit, tainted alcohol, although exactly how it was tainted is another question.
Raquel Rutledge has been the driving force behind the series, which continues to uncover new information on these incidents and the ways in which authorities have tried to conceal them. Raquel, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect.
Thank you for having me.
How did this story first come across your desk?
Abby Connor drowned in January. She's from Pewaukee. And people in the community were talking about it, and I was hearing some circumstances of the death and some of the questions around it, and I thought, that doesn't sound right. When I heard that when the family tried to get answers as to how the drowning occurred, that the hotel wasn't providing answers, wasn't allowing the bartenders to be interviewed and not allowing guests to be interviewed. And then when I heard the police weren't investigating, then I heard the FBI wasn't doing anything. And I think as Americans, we often think, you know, if I'm traveling abroad and I die under mysterious circumstances, that somebody will investigate that. And I heard that wasn't the case. And I just thought, that doesn't sound right. I need to look into this. So I reached out to the family, and they wanted answers as well. And as they told me their story, I just thought, I need to press on this and see what I can find out.
What happened to Abby?
Abby is a 20-year-old young woman from Wisconsin who is a UW-Whitewater student. She and her older brother, Austin, went with their mother and stepfather to an Iberostar resort, a high-end, all-inclusive resort near Playa del Carmen in the Riviera Maya area of Mexico. It was winter break, and they had arrived in the afternoon, threw their bags in their hotel room, and went to the pool, and their mom, Ginny McGowan, and stepfather, John McGowan, went to the beach, and Abby and Austin went to the swim-up bar and at the pool, and, you know, they had a few shots of tequila. Ginny and John ended up meeting them at the pool, and they were all there together, so everything seemed okay. Nothing seemed out of the ordinary. Ginny and John said they were going back to their room to get ready for dinner, and they would meet the kids in the lobby at 7. Ginny and John were in the lobby waiting for them at 7, and then they, you know, 7:15 came, 7:30 came, and there was no sign of Abby or Austin. After a little bit, Ginny went to the front desk and said, hey, could you call the kids' room? The woman behind the desk became flustered and said, you know, she went and grabbed her manager and said, we've been looking for you, and come with us, there's been an accident. So they put them in a cab and sent Ginny and John to the hospital. And when they arrived, they found Austin had been sedated, heavily sedated. He had a big gash on his head, and he didn't recall what had happened at all. And they found that Abby was on life support. And they said that the two of them were found in the pool. Abby was floating face down, and Austin was in the process of drowning. He was out of it, totally disoriented. And they pulled him out and were able to revive him, get him back. But Abby, they were not. So they transferred her to a hospital in Cancun, and then ultimately to Fort Lauderdale, Florida, where she died several days later. You know, they had issues with the hospital, tens of thousands of dollars that they had to pay before they even transferred Abby from the Playa del Carmen Hospital to the Cancun Hospital. And then before they left, it was upwards of $50,000 that they ended up spending, if I recall correctly. Once we published that, which basically we raised a lot of questions. Could they have just had too much to drink and both nearly drowned? Where was everyone else at the resort? This is a resort pool, and it's 6:30, 7 o'clock. You know, what did the bartenders have to say? Did anyone investigate, you know, what they were drinking? Had they done anything else? And I was able to interview Austin, you know, months later, before anyone really understood what might be happening in the big picture. You know, he said, yeah, we had about 4 shots, he thought. He's a bigger guy, and Abby is quite a bit smaller, and he said they drank about the same amount, so you wouldn't expect the two of them to black out at the same time. And again, I later heard many stories like that.
When did all the other stories start emerging? When did it become clear that this wasn't just Abby?
Yeah, I mean, very quickly after we published that first story, which was in the middle of July, I began getting emails and phone calls immediately from other people who said, this happened to us. You know, we were in Mexico and we had a small to moderate amount of alcohol. And, you know, my husband and I blacked out at the same time. And we were robbed or we were assaulted. And I just got numerous calls from couples and other individuals who said something wasn't right. I felt like I had been drugged.
When did it become clear that it was the alcohol?
As I talked to more and more people, that's what they said, is I was taking my second drink and I had a couple of sips of that, and all of a sudden it just, you know, I started seeing stars and just went blank. I kept hearing that. And so what it actually is with the alcohol, I don't know. We don't know. We're trying to find that out. We're still investigating that. Whether it's counterfeit alcohol that's like bootleg moonshine type stuff, which we know, we later learned again, Mexico has huge problems with regulation of their alcohol. There's 36% of the alcohol consumed in Mexico is illicit, which means it's just made under unregulated circumstances. It does not mean it's all contaminated, certainly, but it's produced under unregulated circumstances, so it could just be bypassing the tax stamps. But it also could be made in big vats with just, you know, industrial alcohol with tequila flavoring. Some of the folks I've talked to that work in the liquor industry in Mexico have said that. So we don't know, and I suspect, after talking to dozens and dozens of people, I suspect that there are multiple things happening, that it isn't just, oh, it's contaminated alcohol, or, oh, it's, you know, you were drugged by a bartender. It appears that there are a number of things happening at once.
How has the Mexican government responded to this? How have the hotels responded to these, you know, accusations and these situations?
Yeah. The hotels have completely denied any culpability whatsoever. They say that they, you know, they have solid channels of distribution, that they only purchase sealed bottles. But again, we know it's a problem in Mexico. The government has a program that encourages hotels, restaurants, bars to destroy their liquor bottles when they're empty, to actually like break them, because there's a big black market for those bottles because they get refilled with counterfeit alcohol. So that is a known problem. But the government of Mexico was fairly quick to jump in and appear as though they're doing something. And we don't really have the full details. They did do a sweep within several weeks of us publishing, I believe it was our second story. They went through some of the tourist hotspots and they did a check and they confiscated alcohol. And they did find, they shut down two places. One of them was a lobby bar in that same complex, the resort complex where Abby Connor was. For sanitation reasons, they did find some unlabeled alcohol. They tested it later and said, oh, it was nothing. We found it to be nothing. But again, this is July or August, so it doesn't speak to at all what was happening in January. So this doesn't mean, because you didn't find anything in there, that there wasn't a problem with the alcohol there. But that's kind of the way they're presenting it. And they also did confiscate 10,000 gallons of alcohol that they found to be made under, how do they worded it? It's poor manufacturing practices, is I think the way they described it. And they didn't disclose which distributor that was, the name of the company. They wouldn't say. So they've been, you know, I think trying to do some damage control. I mean, obviously they do. It is really important to them to not have this reputation or to resolve the problem, because they do count heavily on tourism in that area, and especially American tourists.
And it seems like amid these allegations, the Mexican government has also had this kind of PR push of, you know, come to our hotels, come to Mexico.
Absolutely. The governor of Quintana Roo, which is where Cancun and Playa del Carmen are, came to the United States not long ago and met with the State Department folks and other travel writers, tour operators, and launched a big PR blitz to say, you know, Cancun is safe. We want your business. We're on top of it. We're taking extra security measures, and there's nothing to worry about here.
And we can't quite verify that yet.
We can't verify the specifics of what they may or may not be doing.
How has our federal government responded to this?
Well, we have a number of legislators that are trying to get more answers. It was surprising to me to learn that our State Department is really very, very limited in its authority to do much of anything. If you go to the U.S. consulate in Mexico after having been robbed or assaulted looking for help, they are not able to translate for you. They're not able to provide legal advice. They're not really able to do much for you. What they can do is connect you with the proper Mexican authorities, you know, if you didn't know where to go. But the other thing that we found in Mexico, the police they're not equipped like we think in America. When something goes wrong, call the police. That's a lot of our instinct. And that is not what happens there. The resorts are very reluctant to call police. In fact, on many occasions, they told people, you have to go if you want to file a police report. You have to go out to the police station and do that. And in the case of the Valeri family, Jamie and Rick Valeri, they had blacked out after 2.5 drinks, and she awoke to find that she had been assaulted. He had a broken hand, and they were terrified. I mean, they had been to Mexico a number of times. A lot of these folks are huge Mexico fans. They go regularly, and nothing has happened to them in the past, and they really just felt very safe up until their last event there. And with them, they just were terrified. They said, if this happened inside the walls of this resort where I felt like I was safe, I'm certainly not going to go get in a cab with a stranger and go to an unknown place with Mexican police that I don't know how genuine their efforts are to help.
Yeah. One of the more disconcerting parts of this story for me, and maybe this is as someone who uses internet review services a fair amount, I think like most people, is the censorship of these reviews by TripAdvisor. Do we know right now how many people actually wrote in reviews about these incidents?
Not specifically about their troubles at Mexican resorts. We don't have any data because we don't know. I only know the folks that contacted me. And so initially when we wrote that first story about TripAdvisor's policies, we had about a dozen people that had, in the course of just investigating the Mexico stuff, there were a dozen people that said to me in my interviews, you know, hey, we tried to warn other folks. We tried to let people know about this, but we were rejected. Our reviews and our comments were rejected by TripAdvisor. And I thought, that doesn't sound right. I had never heard that. I would not expect that either. And then since we've published that story, again, now many, many more people have come forward to say, we tried to post stuff. We tried to warn people about other, you know, similar events all around the world, not just in Mexico.
How has TripAdvisor responded to this?
They acknowledge that that is a weak spot for them in terms of how they define hearsay, how they their family-friendly guidelines. Their guidelines for posting have evolved and changed. So they are quick to offer up some solutions on that side of things. Yeah, I mean, they've come up with a new system where they hope to warn travelers by putting they're calling it a badge. It's basically a red banner type warning on certain properties, certain establishments that have been the subject of media coverage for health and safety or discrimination reasons. Basically, they've got three categories where they plan to do that. Now, it remains to be seen. I mean, the hotel industry is, you know, has a lot of questions, understandably, as to how these badges will be applied. You know, because what's the criteria? Who's deciding? It's an internal committee. There are plenty of places that have, you know, have had media attention that maybe haven't been flagged yet. And so how they're going to actually manage that is, I think, remains to be seen.
What were the kinds of issues that were in the TripAdvisor reviews that got them booted from the site in the first place?
Yeah, three main things. I mean, hearsay. And so that is, you know, if you say, you know, we heard or my husband said, They want firsthand accounts. Again, a noble sort of approach is like you want people that have actually been there. But the problem with that initially, too, is, I mean, they don't really verify. They don't verify, actually. They don't really verify. They actually do not verify whether you've actually stayed at this place or not. And the reasoning for that is that they want people that didn't actually pay the bill to be able to weigh in terms of verifying. If you only allow people to comment that actually paid the bill, then you limit the rest of the family members or friends who also came but maybe didn't pay. That's their position on that whole verification issue. So the definition of hearsay, though, every person that I interviewed, they were firsthand accounts. This happened to them. Now, there's one woman who, you know, when she blacked out, she had to say, well, my husband helped me out of the pool or whatever because she was blacked out. I mean, is that hearsay? The other reason that they cited for taking posts down or limiting them was the family-friendly guidelines. They don't want graphic descriptions of crimes and injuries and that sort of thing. And so, but like I said, that has changed a bit to where they're allowing more. In the case of the sexual assaults, there was not graphic description in the first place. So I didn't fully understand that answer didn't, like the family-friendly guideline for the sexual assault of Christy Love, it was not graphic in any way. And the other second thought I have, I guess, on that is, like, you don't typically have your children booking your trips, so you're not going to have a lot of young people under 16 or even under 18 probably reading this because that's not what they do.
Does even saying sexual assault, does even saying rape, does that count as, did they explain that, if that counts as being graphic?
No, it was not defined. And so now, to their credit, what they're doing now is they're going to be very specific. And when you submit a review, it'll pin the exact words and the exact sentence. And so you'll know specifically, because that was another complaint that I heard from people. They said, hey, hearsay, but they didn't tell me which part of my review or comments were hearsay. So now they are going to specify.
Okay. So what's next for you?
Gosh, we have another number of other angles to explore on this whole thing. Still looking for answers, still talking to people that are knowledgeable about what's been happening there of late. There's a lot of crime that's going on. There's a lot of other issues kind of exploding in that region right now.
All right. Well, Raquel, I wish you luck, and thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect.
Oh, thank you so much for your interest in the story. It's important. Thanks.
Raquel Rutledge is an investigative journalist for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. She's been reporting on the deaths and injuries sustained at Mexican resorts in a series of reports since July. There are links and more information at WUWM.com.
We'll talk with the CEO of a Wisconsin-based health insurer about the changing insurance landscape when Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio.
More of Lake Effect Now on WUWM. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Joy Powers. For State of Wisconsin employees, including employees at UW-Milwaukee, the health insurance open enrollment period brought a lot of questions. Most of the insurance companies who previously offered coverage will no longer do so in 2018. State employees in the Milwaukee area have only two companies to choose from.
One is the Menasha-based Network Health, which also made the recent decision to remain on the Milwaukee County Exchange, despite uncertainty over the future of the Affordable Care Act. Corrine Dykus-Johnson is president and CEO of Network Health and joins us in the studio now to talk about the health insurance landscape as she sees it. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Can you talk about the factors that led Network Health to continue to insure state employees, whereas a number of other insurers have left the market?
Absolutely. Well, first of all, we were grateful that we were offered the opportunity to earn the business of State of Wisconsin employees because it's a great opportunity for Network Health to grow. We have been serving State of Wisconsin employees for almost 30 years, mostly in our northeast region, the Fox Valley. So with regard to the southeastern Wisconsin, this was a major shift because, unlike in many years past, you had the national carriers who have very broad networks competing for your business, competing for state employee business. And so while we've been in the southeastern Wisconsin region for a few years, obviously members and employees who had opportunity to choose from a broad network and still have the same amount of employee contribution or employer contribution, it was an easy choice to make, right? Because you have a broad network. Well, this was the first time in a number of years, at least in my knowledge base, where there were narrow networks that were offered to State of Wisconsin employees in the Milwaukee or Metro Milwaukee area. And so there were two, Network Health and WEA Trust. And we have, for the most part, very distinct networks of providers in our system. And so while the benefits are the same, what we were, in essence, competing against was our network of providers and then obviously our customer service. Network Health is owned by two of the largest healthcare providers in Wisconsin, Frederick Health and Ascension Wisconsin. And so we were great to be able to offer that to state of Wisconsin employees. I will tell you that I personally spent time at the UWM open enrollment where I got the opportunity to talk to professors and all level of associates at the university to understand a little bit of the angst in the decision that they had to make. And in one of the things that helped, in my opinion, when I had those associates in front of me who were expressing angst was, you know, if they were treating with a nephrologist or with whoever, they wanted to know that they had an opportunity to find another physician to provide great care. Just one caveat I'll mention, you know, in Wisconsin, we are very fortunate to have excellent health care, and regardless of the system, I mean, we have a very competitive environment here, but that competition has really driven the quality of the care, whether in, I would say this about our competitor owners, our owners and our competitors, we have great quality of care here. So I felt great comfort in being able to help them navigate to find a new physician.
This part of the state is also somewhat known if for quality, also for cost. You know, and a lot has been made about the cost of healthcare in the Milwaukee area in particular. And I'm curious, from an insurer's standpoint, what you see leading to costs here versus costs anywhere else in the country?
Well, I would first like to say that Milwaukee and southeastern Wisconsin in particular has made excellent strides in bridging and reducing the delta between our costs in the Midwest compared to our Midwestern cities that are here. So over the last 15 years, there have been tremendous efforts by the hospital systems to reduce their costs. They're using lean principles, looking at different ways to provide care in a more cost-effective manner, whether it's utilizing more services in an outpatient setting. And I would argue also that the consolidation in terms of how they've been able to manage, you know, everything from HR to IT has absolutely been able to draw down those costs. And I think that there's the value-based contracting that they've done with not only insurers like Network Health, but also national carriers, where they are looking to be paid based on quality and outcome. And you've seen that as a tremendous amount of opportunity for improvement. And moreover, in the last few years, we've seen an absolute improvement in terms of the medical cost trend, and it's been in the single digits. So as a former hospital president, I would tell you that I've seen firsthand the amount of effort that has been put in place to be able to really stem costs and be able to be competitive. And the fact of the matter is and maintain and excel in the quality side of the care that we provide.
That said, to go back to the beginning of the question, you know, the fact that such efforts have been undertaken to rein in the costs here, what do you think led to the costs being, you know, higher in the first place?
Well, there's a lot of opinion about that. Some of it is around the benefits, right? I mean, you know, whether or not individuals are taking in terms of health plan designs, the type of benefits that people enjoy, how people have taken an actual interest in their own health care. And I would argue that it's not only the healthcare systems in terms of working towards driving down costs and increasing quality, but it's also been an observation on employers in terms of the plans that they've been purchasing and the wellness programs that they've been putting in place. So I would say that I think one of the other things that's really starting to drive down costs is that it's a partnership also on the employers. Employers, they are the payer. They are paying the bills, and they have also really taken this to heart to look at the plan designs, and how do we make sure that everybody is focusing on improving their own health and knowledgeable about the health care that they consume.
We mentioned the open enrollment period for state employees. I also wanted to ask you about, you know, there's all this, you know, uncertainty in the healthcare reform debate at this moment. What were the factors that led you to decide to remain on the Milwaukee County Exchange? Because again, it could have easily, you know, there are plenty of cases around the country of insurers deciding to leave exchanges.
Absolutely, and Wisconsin was another one. For 2018, two large national carriers have decided to leave the Marketplace Exchange, and so. Obviously, we look at these things differently because we have provider owners, and our focus is to make sure that we can provide our owners with access to these patients and our members. And so, you know, from a mission perspective, this fits perfectly within the mission of Network Health and our owners. And so being able to be available to many. I mean, there's about 70,000 lives, 70,000 people in the state of Wisconsin who will be looking for a new healthcare option. And so for us, it was very important for us to answer the call. Our provider owners were both Frederick and Ascension were excited to have us to continue to participate, have allowed for us to improve our outreach to our members. So we're ready for the members who select Network Health. They will have outreach by their physician partners in this to make sure that they get their health and wellness exams. And we're excited to continue to participate.
Let me turn back. Well, I mean, I guess it's linked to that and also linked to the shift in coverage for state employees. Potentially, you're talking about thousands of people in a span of just a few months who are changing their coverage. Is it a logistical challenge? Are there concerns that you have as the leader of this company of bringing all these new people potentially in under the Network Health umbrella? At the same time?
It's a great question, and it's actually one that we anticipated. We knew that there was based on early in the calendar year, we knew that there was a great opportunity for Network Health to grow in 2018. So we put a lot of effort into preparing ourselves for growth. When I started as the CEO a little over a year ago, I just celebrated my one-year anniversary.
Congratulations on that, yes.
Thank you. But that was one of the first things that I wanted the company to prepare for was growth. As we were growing in southeastern Wisconsin, we wanted to make sure that the excellent customer service that our Northeastern clients and customers have not only come accustomed to but expect from Network Health that we would be able to deliver to Southeastern. And so we prepared and began preparing early in 17 for this. And so we are ready.
Are the decisions about who's covering state employees, say, made a year before that goes into or you were just sort of counting on shifts in the industry?
Well, with regard to the state of Wisconsin, initially, you may recall there were bids to put that out as a self-insured.
Right.
And we were one of the bidders. And matter of fact, we were one of the recipients of the contract had it gone that way. And so the expectation, and there were several different options that the state could have taken. We expected that they would be looking for a way to consolidate. We were correct on that. And so that's what we planned for. And so we were able to bring it into our operation plans.
Corinne Dykus-Johnson, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Corinne Dykus-Johnson is president and CEO of Menasha-based Network Health.
An athlete who 4 years ago shared her story of being sexually abused as a teen reflects on how the climate for stories like hers is changing. That's when Lake Effect returns on WUWM.
More of Lake Effect, I'm Joy Powers.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. A fifth woman came forward on Monday to accuse Alabama Republican Senate candidate Roy Moore of making sexual advances at her when she was a teenager. Both Democrats and some Republicans have pressured Moore to drop out of the race.
But the allegations against Moore are just the latest in a changing climate surrounding sexual misconduct, or at least the reporting of it. In recent weeks, people have come forward to tell stories of sexual advances and assault. Allegations have been made against producer Harvey Weinstein, actor Kevin Spacey, comedian Louis C.K., and journalist Michael Oreskes and Mark Halperin, among others.
It is certainly a different climate today than it was 4 years ago when former U.S. speed skater Bridie Farrell spoke out on Lake Effect about her sexual abuse at age 15 by a teammate who was in his 30s. At least one other skater spoke out publicly, and Andy Gabel subsequently admitted to what he termed a brief inappropriate relationship. Today, Farrell is working to change laws regarding sexual crimes against children, and we reached her in New York. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you so much, Mitch.
All right, so we're seeing new disclosures nearly every day, allegations and even some admissions of sexual misconduct by men generally in positions of power over the women who are bringing these cases to light. Given what you did 4 years ago, how would you describe, I guess, your feelings about the climate that seems to make at least it's somewhat easier to be heard today?
Well, I think that the tidal wave of women coming forward and having the strength to speak up to their abusers who, like you said, predominantly are in positions of power. The environment of one woman doing it, 2, 4, 8, that tidal wave is what's allowing it to happen. And from a personal standpoint, every day is really tough. But from a personal standpoint also, every day is amazing that there's so much, even the word would be sisterhood, of so many people understand and so many people get it. And folks that have been scared for years have finally found that voice and that strength to come forward and speak out.
And of course, I didn't want to suggest either that it makes it easier to tell these stories. Given your insights, is there a risk in thinking the women who are coming forward today are finding it any easier to discuss these things, even with the changing climate?
Your question there is perfect, that it's never easy. It's never fun. It's never done for fame or for fortune. It's hard. It's still hard for me to tell my story, and I've been telling it publicly for 4 years. However, yes, having someone say, I've been there too, I get it. Having someone say, hashtag, I believe you, is a big deal and really helpful. And then having 100 people say it is huge. The flip side of that is there are still men who don't believe it when multiple women are coming forward and saying the exact same story. So there's still two sides to the problem.
Well, and the other thing we don't seem to be seeing, even as some men are like Louis C.K. are admitting to their conduct, we don't see any of this right now translating into changes in the laws regarding this behavior and or the statute of limitations regarding it. But that is, I gather, something that you have been working on, right?
That's exactly it. It's really empowering that so many women are coming forward. And now we're seeing the gymnasts come forward who were underage. However, what people also don't understand is that the statute of limitations for child sexual abuse is actually quite short. And these perpetrators are still on the street. So I personally am working round the clock to try and pass the Child Victims Act, which would extend the statute of limitations in New York State.
What is the statute of limitations in New York State, and where do things stand as far as that legislation goes?
So the statute of limitations for nearly all child sex abuse crimes in New York State is 5 years. So that means an individual has until age 23 to report. What the Child Victims Act does is it extends the criminal and civil aspects of the law. It also eliminates the 90-day notice of claim for public institution. And then the third tier is that it allows a window of for survivors of sexual abuse an opportunity to call out their abusers in civil court on a retroactive way. And some say that the purpose of this retroactive opportunity is justice for the survivor. And although some survivors of child sexual abuse might find healing through the process of suing their abuser, the biggest part is that it names the abuser who is still on the street abusing kids. I mean, these aren't one and done kind of guys. It's systematic that they grow up and the girls all stay 15 years old. So when that girl outgrows him, he just gets another victim. And so that's why that opportunity to identify known abusers is so important, as well as holding institutions accountable.
As we're having this conversation, you mentioned gymnasts are now coming forward, most notably Allie Raisman on 60 Minutes in the last few days. But are you seeing national sports federations being any more responsive to the kinds of issues that you've brought up and others have brought up in the past 4, 5, 10 years?
Personally, no. I haven't seen any of the national governing bodies of the Olympic sports taking any responsibility in this. I went on USA Gymnastics webpage today and with a bit of digging was able to find a press release that mentioned that they stand with Allie, but that's pretty lame. I mean, what the woman has been through is, I can tell you firsthand, it's pretty horrific. And there's a lot of, well, USA Gymnastics now has safe sport. Well, in order to be in the Olympic Committee, you have to have safe sport. So it's not as if it's voluntary. But it's the same as we're seeing in Hollywood, where it's quote unquote known that these guys do this. And Hollywood can let go of whether it's Louis C.K. or Weinstein or, you know, Paul DeJour, but these athletes are the product. And so the situation is very different. An actress can be picked up by another producer who has moral conviction, but an athlete where there's only one national team coach, that's all you have. You can't just pick up your bags and go and train someplace else. You're in high school. And so it really falls upon the adults that are running these organizations to protect the kids. And it just seems so insultingly backwards that here we are 4 years after me and how many years after other survivors of abuse in sports have spoken, and we're having the same conversation. It's discouraging, really.
This is part of the national conversation today, but do you have concerns about how the national conversation takes place and how frequently the conversation changes, that we could all be talking about this today and a week from now or a month from now, it could all be, you know, thrown to the back pages?
Well, it's not going to stay. The topic of sexual abuse is not going to stay on the front pages forever, but the conversation about sexual abuse will be changed forever. Just even surrounding the words, the hashtag of Me Too, like the amount of women that came forward and told such personal stories and the amount of vulnerability that women shared is just a huge thing.
Do you think what you did 4 years ago had played a role in what all of these women have been able to do today?
I think that we've all played a role, and when one of us is not safe, none of us are safe. And so if my speaking up was part of this momentum, I'm happy to have played that part. But I know that when each one of these women speak, it resonates with me, and it helps me. So I hope that I've helped other folks along the way. And also I hope that I've bring the awareness to men, and that they reflect and think about what's right and what are boundaries and what's consent, and in my situation, what's downright illegal. And now we just need, like I said, governing bodies and then legislative bodies to update their standards.
Well, Bridie Farrell, thank you again. Good luck to you.
Thanks so much.
Bridie Farrell is a former U.S. speed skater. Today, she's working in her home state of New York to change laws regarding the statute of limitations for sexual crimes against children. You can find links to her story and more coverage of the issue at WUWM.com.
One more break, and then maybe our most fit for you guest, American Ninja Warrior competitor Abel Gonzalez, shares his remarkable backstory when Lake Effect continues on WUWM. More of Lake Effect Now. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Joy Powers. The athletes on the TV show American Ninja Warrior do some amazing things. From climbing up ropes to ascending the warped wall, their abilities far surpass what most of us could hope to accomplish.
But professional ninja warrior Abel Gonzalez has worked extremely hard to accomplish what many of us take for granted. At 10, he left a difficult family life in Chicago to live with his grandmother and brother in Texas. In his early 20s, his dreams of playing pro football were interrupted by a diagnosis of rheumatoid arthritis that doctors said would cripple him by 30.
So Gonzalez added fighting RA to his athletic training. And by changing his workout, his mindset, and his diet, he was able to become the man he is today, competing on television and training others.
For this month's Fit for You, Gonzalez joined Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski in the studio and shared what led him to work out and speak out.
It's the challenge, yeah. There's a challenge here. And when it came down to it, it's like I can be the best athlete possible. And I know a lot of the athletes on the show are stronger than me. They're more experienced. But I knew that one advantage I was going to have is my composure, is the ability to stay calm under this extremely high stress situation, because we only have one chance every year. One mistake and we're out, right? Mm-hmm. And the pressure is insanely high on this show, more than anything, because it's not like a team sport where the team comes together and they share that pressure, right, to win. This is you, one person, with hundreds of people around, cameras everywhere, lights, it's 3 a.m. This is your one chance to make it to the national finals, or at least to the next round. And you have to stay calm and focused. So it can be very tough. And it is a hindrance to a lot of amazing athletes on the program. You know, they're better athletes than I am. And I'm not afraid to admit that. You know, I know I'm not the best. I know that I am very, very good at trying to be my best. And that's why I've been able to advance and be where I am today. But focusing on turning things like nervousness into excitement, or meditation and breathing practices and learning to calm down, and those are the kind of the things that I think have helped me do what I do.
Also, what is particularly amazing outside of conditioning your body to be able to perform at this level in this sport is that you've also overcome a diagnosis of rheumatoid arthritis that technically should have put you in a wheelchair by now.
Yeah, that was probably, there's literally a 99% chance that that's going to disable you or drastically decrease your quality of life for the rest of your life. It's an incurable autoimmune disease. And I was diagnosed when I was 23. But I spent 3 years taking painkillers, covering it up, not knowing what it was. I just thought it was general arthritis.
So how did you go from a very heavy sentence with rheumatoid arthritis potentially disabling you on almost all fronts to being able to compete at such a high level? You know, people think arthritis, gripping something, mm-hmm. moving, running, yeah. Extremely painful. Yet here you are doing the extreme of
the most extreme thing
that you could do. Yeah. So how did you turn that around and find ways to condition your body to, well, not necessarily ignore those brain signals, but mm-hmm. how did you make it work for you?
When I first was diagnosed, I was told in a way that was kind of rough. I was told, hey, you have rheumatoid arthritis. You have about 7 years of movement left. At that point, you'll be in a wheelchair the rest of your life, or you're going to need several surgeries to fix your knees and your hips. And I was even told that there was not much they could do for me as far as prescription medications and things. It had been kind of quick as far as the diagnosis and its attack on my body, right? So that's what I was told, and I literally was in shock. I had never heard of the illness. I was discouraged. I was sad. I was angry. There was a lot of emotions going through it. And I just knew that if they couldn't help me, then I was going to do it myself. I wasn't going to accept that, because this was my life. I wasn't going to let an illness take it away from me, because I did rely on sport. I was a provider for my family and for my brothers, and I was going to make the most of this life no matter what. So when they told me that, I had a prescription. They gave me a prescription for a stronger pain medication, and I got in my car in the parking lot that day, and I crumpled it. I crumpled the prescription. I said, if they can't help me, that's okay. I'm going to find a way. I'm going to do this. And I started reading. Started trying to figure out what this was, and I knew that it was serious and the information was negative, but there has to be something, you know, because it's an autoimmune disease and that's my body attacking itself. And instead of saying rheumatoid arthritis is an incurable autoimmune disease, I said, what if it's just an allergic reaction? What if I'm just having a reaction? And so then that gave me hope to look and try everything I could possibly find. And I did. I read and studied for months till 2, 3, 4 in the morning. You know, I was literally reading and trying to study and figure this out to save my life. And when I speak at schools, I tell them I probably studied more than you did and I wasn't even in school. You know, I was trying to save my life. And I tried everything I could possibly find. Even it didn't make sense. A lot of things that I tried did not make sense, but some of those things were working. And I'm here now.
Yeah, and thriving.
Yes, doing my best.
And with your research, your own journey of finding what works best for your body, of understanding the physicality of your body, I imagine you have a new appreciation for your body and what it can do. So how are you using that to help others?
Being an example. That's all I can do, right? You know, you can go out and give as much advice as you want. You can have the best advice in the world and you can share it to everybody. But if you're not living it, then it's going to fall on deaf ears, right? No one's going to hear or believe it. So that's my goal. And that came from being an older brother, you know, with my younger brothers and things. I wanted to help them and didn't want them to be depressed, you know, and I wanted them to have a life of purpose and passion. So it was being an example. And that's how I do it. I go out and I be an example. I do a lot of the things that I could do on the show. If I can, I do it in front of them so they can feel and see the impact and remember that, right? And I know, too, that I had examples. I'm not the first person to be diagnosed with rheumatoid arthritis and have visual damage and go through all that and then come out and be able to be their best, right? Actually, the best version of themselves. I'm just the one that did an American Ninja Warrior, right? But there's some incredible people. You know, a friend of mine, Jenny, in Dallas, she's a yoga teacher. And she went through almost the exact same thing, and now she teaches yoga. And I also use yoga. You know, I use movement to let my body perform its best, right? So movement itself is a detoxing. It's medicine. Movement can be medicine. And the more you move, the more you detox. Other things, of course, nutrition is a huge, huge factor in that. And then mentality, right? I had this mentality that I wasn't going to let this stop me.
With being an example and spreading your message not only to schools and other organizations, you also own Axios Gym back in Texas, and it's exclusively teaching kids the skills needed comparable to being a ninja warrior in this sport. And I imagine that kids are the perfect students to have because they have no fear.
Well, yeah, you know, and I think as we get older, we put fear in ourselves, right? Like,
yeah.
Oh, I couldn't do that. I'm going to fall and break my leg. Oh, yeah, if you're saying that, you're literally just told your body that that's what's going to happen, and you're reinforcing that fear, and you're not going to want to try. So, yeah, it's fun. It's a lot of fun doing these obstacles and training for them. And kids, because they're movers, we're all movers, right? But they haven't been deconditioned out of movement. They haven't been sitting at desks for, you know, 20 years like some of us or typing and wearing shoes for such a long time that they can still move and they don't have those fears and those pains. They get injured, but we heal, right? We have a system to heal. And that happens. But when I see them doing obstacles, I'm like, man, they do it easier than I do. It's like, and I'm the one on the show, you know, and they're over here doing it easier than me. It's like, oh my gosh, I wish I was still a kid. That's part of my drive of what I do. My movement is to go back to the way when I was a kid because that's when it was fun. That's when it was healthy and I was happier, you know, and it really helped with my relationships, with my outlook on life to be, you know, having fun with movement, whether it's sports or yoga or biking, CrossFit. There's a lot of ways to move. And to me, this is just the pinnacle because it's so well-rounded. Everything from your fingertips to your toes. I do a lot of videos on my social media showing how I can use my hands and my fingers and my toes to do things that I never thought I could do. But it was just having fun with movement and practicing and realizing how important it is for our body to be moving.
You're a part of an elite group of only 5 athletes who are classified as pro ninja warriors. How are you trying to make this sport more accessible when it requires, you know, not only so much unique equipment and gym space to do it, you yourself quit your job to pursue getting a spot on the American Ninja Warrior,
yeah.
Waited 5 days in line as a walk-in. You know, it's a lot of commitment. It's not going to a local gym and signing up for a monthly membership. How are you trying to change this?
Well, it is a new sport. Right. So when I started, yeah, things were a little bit different. You know, I started 4 years ago, and it's grown so much to where now there's probably a gym, a Ninja Warrior gym in your area now, and you can go and train. And that's all it is. It looks very demanding, right? And that's because it is. It is very demanding. And the truth is the sport drives itself because it's fun. You know, it's varied. It's okay, well, there's a balance obstacle. Now there's an upper body obstacle. Now there's an agility obstacle, and I got to run like this and do this and jump here. And I have to train on ropes. I have to train on fingertips. I have to train on rock climbing. So it's so varied that it never really gets boring, right? And it looks hard. And if you're an adult, you just have to have patience and realize, like, it's going to come no matter what's going on. If you're in the gym and you're training and you're having fun with this and asking questions and learning, you're getting better.
So you yourself, you're in great health. You've overcome and been able to manage your diagnosis of rheumatoid arthritis, and you're helping others, not only in your own community, but across the U.S. What do you see as your next or biggest challenge?
I the sport is new, right? And it's been on for 9 years, and there's only been one official winner in the 9 years out of thousands and thousands of people. I'm one of the very few to get very close to winning the show. Out of all those thousands of people, about 20 have made it to the round, right? To nearly the final round, right? And I was one of those guys. And I would like to win the show. I would also like to win a few times, right? Like, I don't just want to be a one-time winner. I want to go and win the show a few times. And I know that that pursuit is healthy. I have to train. I have to keep these mentalities and practicing and getting better. And it's a great sport for longevity. And I know that I will be capable because of the way I'm approaching it now. So I see it as a long-term goal to be a competitor for 20 years, right, and be a multiple-time winner. I also do enjoy speaking, and I know it has a huge impact. And that's an interesting thing because going through all the things that I went through when I was a kid, I would always say to myself, hey, man, it's okay. Just make it through. One day, thousands of people are going to hear your story. You're going to tell them this story. And then now in presentations, it's like, It was actually millions of people worldwide were going to hear my story and know who I was because of what I've done. That's it. Whether you're at my academy or if you're at one of my presentations, that's my goal, to make sure that you know that you can overcome all the obstacles, be an example, and be a part of that positive change in the future.
We are all able, right?
We are all able. I see that every day in my gym, and I get some little bit of feedback on that. Well, Abel, we can't do 3 pull-ups with 90 pounds, or we can't climb on this rock wall with our fingertips. I'm like, well, if I can do it, you can do it. Training and practice, and you'll do it. And they end up doing it. And that's when I say, I told you. We were all able.
Well, Abel, best of luck to you in the future. I'm sure myself and many, many other people will be watching your career. Thank you for coming in to talk about it today.
You know, I appreciate it. Thank you for having me.
Abel Gonzalez is a professional American Ninja Warrior, motivational speaker, and owner of Axios Gym in Texas. He spoke with Audrey Nowakowski ahead of a Tuesday evening event for kids at Sky Zone in Waukesha. You can hear more of the conversation at WUWM.com. And that's today's edition of the show. I'm Joy Powers.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Thanks so much for tuning in today. And I sure hope you'll be with us again tomorrow at 10 for another Lake Effect on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee.
Stay tuned. Fresh Air is next.